Okay, no movie this week, but a Super Bowl commercial. A rancher on a white horse. A family at the movies. A group of teenage surfers. Some kids street dancing. A family on vacation to the Grand Canyon. A family camping. A family eating out. Two men in yarmulkes. A woman in a hijab. Some children at a swimming pool. A family at a roller rink. Guys playing handball. A woman dancing. Kids lying on leaves, dancing and running. Some were white, Hispanic, black, Asian, Jewish, Arab, Native American, maybe Persian. Some were old. Some were young. Some women, some men. Some of the families had two dads. Some were urban. Some were rural. All were smiling and enjoying life in America. These were among the people pictured in a commercial for Coca-Cola in 2014 that ran again before the Super Bowl this year. Behind these beautiful images of beautiful Americans, America the Beautiful was being sung in a variety of languages. I remember seeing the commercial before, but this time it really hit home. What a wonderful celebration of America and of life. The wonder, the beauty, the diversity, the joy. You won't be surprised to hear, not everyone saw beauty in Coca-Cola's America is Beautiful ad. Almost immediately after the ad aired, social media was bombarded with comments. Many were supportive and many were not. Most of those that weren't were hurtful and hateful. So much so, it would be inappropriate for me to share them. Why? Why would such a beautiful ad celebrating our unity in diversity, e pluribus unum, out of many, one? Why would such a beautiful ad be met with such hate? I suppose some of it is xenophobia, an intense, irrational dislike or fear of people from other countries. But maybe it's not quite right to label it xenophobia, because I believe everyone in the video was American. Perhaps it would be better to label it racism or prejudice. As my grandfather used to say, you don't see robins and blue jays flocking together. Some of the hate was directed at Muslims. I'm sure others didn't like the family with two dads. But most of the hate seemed directed at the music. Foreigners, quote unquote, were singing America the Beautiful in their native languages, albeit American foreigners. Now, I'm not naive. I know emotions run high around language. Many feel strongly if someone is going to make America their home, they should learn the language, English. Do you think the irony is lost on them? I mean, Squanto and Sacagawea learned English, but I don't think English was their mother tongue. So by all rights, English really isn't our native language. Friends, I'm not sure the label matters. xenophobic, racist, prejudice, all are rooted in fear. Fear is the source of our anger and hatred. Fear of those who are different. Fear of the other. Before 1790, the other was the indigenous people inhabiting our land, as well as slaves from Africa and the Caribbean. In the early 1800s, the other was the German, the Irish, the Scots. In the late 1800s, the other was people from the Middle East, China, Japan, Mexico, Jews from Eastern Europe, and Armenians from Turkey. In the early 1900s, immigration slowed, in part because of the Great Depression, and in part because our nation rejected most of the refugees fleeing Nazi persecution. But fear of the other grew during that time. Americans of German and Italian descent were detained. Americans of Japanese descent were interred in camps and lost most, if not all, of their personal property. In 1988, the American government recognized such sweeping measures against American citizens on the basis of perceived fear were unconscionable and apologized. You know the rest of the story. We long to believe we are a nation proclaiming to the world, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. We long to be America the Beautiful. But too often we are moved more by our fear of the other than our faith in God. This morning, we are at the heart of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. A couple weeks ago, Jesus' sermon opened with a litany of blessings on those who live the kingdom life. The poor and poor in spirit, those who mourn and grieve, the humble and meek, those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, those who show mercy, and those who make peace. In the words of Micah, those who do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with God. As foolish as it may seem to the world, all of these people are blessed in the eyes of God. Last Sunday, we focused on Jesus' charge to live this kingdom life ourselves. Like those who first heard Jesus' words, living in a dystopian world of fear and despair under Roman oppression, like those who first heard Jesus' sermon, we were challenged by his revolutionary words. God created us to be salt and light. God created us to be the source of hope for a hopeless, desperate people. God created us to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with our God. This morning, the rubber hits the road. Having made clear he has come to fulfill God's law and not replace it, Jesus offers his interpretation. You have heard it said, but I say to you. Speaking specifically about anger, adultery, divorce, oaths, vengeance, and love, Jesus offers an interpretation of God's law, claiming not only our behavior, but our intentions, claiming our hearts as well as our lives. In Jesus' eyes, God's command, "Do not kill," now prohibits anger and insults. To be clear, it's not that we can't get angry. Anger is an emotion. What Jesus is saying is our anger shouldn't define our relationships. When we are angry, we don't go post on Facebook. We should respond with generosity and grace, forgiveness, and reconciliation. God's command, "Do not commit adultery," now prohibits predatory thoughts and behavior. Because when we objectify people, we can't be in relationship with them. The Torah's provision for divorce gave undue power to men. Restraining this power, Jesus has tried to level the playing field. Oaths, too, were permitted by the Torah, as long as they were truthful. For Jesus, oaths aren't necessary. Our integrity should stand alone. Our word is our word. And our word is made good not by swearing, but by our truthfulness. In place of vengeance, which was also regulated by the Torah, Jesus commands nonviolent resistance. Living the kingdom life, we're not called to ignore or accept abuse, but neither are we to respond in kind. We are to confound the oppressor. We are to restore the dignity of the oppressed through nonviolent methods. In his final point, Jesus takes the Torah's command to love our neighbors a step further. "Anyone can love their friends," he says. For Jesus, enemies are also neighbors. Therefore, we are to love not just those who love us, but our enemies, the other as well. The common theme running through all of these examples is godly relationships. Speaking to a desperate, hopeless people, living a dystopian life under Roman imperialism, Jesus offers the kingdom life as an alternative. This is how God's people are to live. This is how God's people are to be in relationship with each other. Jesus says, "You have heard it said, in regard to murder, adultery, divorce, oaths, vengeance, and love. You have heard it said in your relationships with others. All that matters is your outward behavior, the appearance. You are holy. But I say to you, to keep you from becoming whitewashed tombstones, I say to you, I have come to claim not only your behavior, but your intentions, not only your lives, but your heart. There are some who would say Jesus raises the bar too high. Others, Jesus never intended for us to take his words literally. Still others, it is unrealistic to expect us to live this way. Anger, adultery, divorce, revenge, prejudice, hatred, violence, fear, such is life for sinful people living in a sinful world. But what if we do take Jesus' words to heart? Could it be Jesus' high expectations reflect his faith in us to be the people God calls us to be? Could it be Jesus believes by God's grace we can be salt and light to the world? Could it be when Christ truly claims our hearts, such a life, the kingdom life of Jesus Christ, is possible? Have you ever wished we had more young families in church? Frankly, I'd take some old families today. Rhetorical question. How many of you think it has to do with worship style or relevance or sports on Sunday mornings? That should cover just about all of you. The truth is, there is enough truth in those answers to make them distracting. But they're not the issue. The problem is the life we are living. On the outside, it looks really good. A lot better than it looked 4 years ago. But have we truly allowed Christ to claim our hearts? Our children are watching. They hear the hateful things we say. They see the hurtful things we do. They read our posts. They watch as we justify ourselves rather than seeking repentance for what we've done wrong. But they know, and we know in our hearts, how wrong we are to be petty, vindictive, and hateful. Why would they trust anything we say about loving God if we don't love our neighbors? Why would they want anything to do with church if it doesn't seem to make much difference in our lives? Friends, as good church folk, we must do better by our children. And by God's grace, we can. Beloved, grace is the power to live life differently, letting Christ claim our hearts. Grace is the power to be hurt and to forgive. Grace is the power to be angry and seek reconciliation, to be wrong and ask to be forgiven, to be humble rather than righteous, to love our enemies, to change systems of injustice, to make peace. Grace is the power to look upon this beautifully diverse world, to hear the cacophony of voices, to see the many shades of beauty, to embrace the richness of the cultures and call them good. Thanks be to God.